we have in place right now, said CENTCOM Commander General Kenneth McKenzie in a briefing with reporters recently. Despite earlier reports that the government has numerous contracts with companies stretching far beyond the deadline to leave, it would appear the thrust of U.S. operations in Afghanistan is diminishing and the withdrawal has begun. Even if that takes a while, or the United States manages to keep some presence in the country after September 11th, the private sector footprint will never be as big as it was at its height in 2011, when there were over 90,000 contractors in Afghanistan. At times, including now, contractors outnumbered uniformed personnel. To put it into practice, there were 155,000 contractors in Iraq and Afghanistan compared to 145,000 active duty service members in 2011. Contractors made up 62% of the workforce. The money paid to contractors is even more daunting. $104 billion for services in Afghanistan alone since 2002, nearly $9 billion just in the last 5 years. With so much dependence on contractors came trouble. Huge companies like Halliburton, with subsidiaries such as KBR, took advantage. Not only were companies overcharging and caught engaging in fraud during the early salad days, but worse, they cut corners to make more money. Who could forget the flimsy, defective showers and electrical systems, electro-cutting trips throughout Iraq, the unsafe drinking water on bases, spoiled food? Then there are the contractors who help torture inmates at Abu Ghraib and massacred civilians at Nisr Square. Armed mercenaries who rolled with CIA in secret, trained troops, guarded dignitaries. Many died with no mention in the papers, came home injured and sick, with none of the benefits of Pentagon Healthcare or VA. They were a shadow army, really, a massive experiment in how Uncle Sam could wage war across several countries cheaper and longer by leaning on the private sector to do it. But it wasn't cheaper, and the cost not just in dollars. For every positive thing contractors did in country, there is a school or a hospital or some facility that literally won't stand after they're gone. Halliburton and KBR and Blackwater are names of the past, but they got their gold. They care not about the graveyard of empires. Others like Fluor Group, which provides logistical support to the military currently in Afghanistan, are going to see an end to their lush days, and they're feeling it. The timetable to do this properly is already too tight, said David Bertu, president of the Professional Services Council, representing 400 government contractors, many working in Afghanistan. We don't have years, we have only months. All good things must come to an end, right?
New allegations are swirling around British Prime Minister Boris Johnson about misusing funds received from Conservative Party donations. The Prime Minister stands accused of infringing the law by using the funds to renovate his residence at No. 11 Downing Street. The allegation has prompted an Electoral Commission probe into the matter, which can take months to complete. Johnson maintains that he has personally paid for the costs of the renovation.
Who initially, and Prime Minister, initially is the key word here, who initially paid for the redecoration of his Downing Street flat?
As for the latest stuff that he's bringing up, he should know that I've paid for Downing Street refurbishment personally, Mr. Speaker, and any further declaration that I have to make, I will, if any, I will be advised upon by Lord Guy.
However, the British Prime Minister did not clarify whether he initially made the payments.
Well, if any of the three reviews into his conduct find that he broke the ministerial code, then Johnson would be expected to resign, but just expected, is how it says. But the code has already proved useless, really, like in the case of Scottish First Minister Nicola Sturgeon, but she did a lot worse. But really, I don't think the Electoral Commission, which is investigating, it's conducting at least one of the investigations, will really want to bring down the leader of an elected government with a large majority.
The latest allegation, which is referred to by the British media as the sleaze row, comes only days before local elections across the country are scheduled to be held. A recent opinion poll now shows the ruling Conservatives are losing their lead over the opposition Labour Party. Apart from the redecoration scandal, there have been other unconfirmed reports that the Conservative Party donors have been solicited funds for personal matters. The Sunday Times has cited a British MP as saying that he had received a complaint from a donor who was asked to pay for Boris Johnson's child's nanny. A spokesperson for the Prime Minister's office dismissed the report, saying Johnson had paid all the childcare costs himself, but she didn't respond to a question about who had initially made the payment. But that's not the only report tarnishing the Prime Minister's image. He's recently being grilled about whether or not he had said he would rather see bodies piled up in their thousands than declare another nationwide lockdown. Remarks he flatly rejects ever making.
Prime Minister.
No, Mr. Speaker, and I think the Right Honourable Gentleman is a lawyer, I'm given to understand. I think that if he's going to repeat allegations like that, he should come to this House and substantiate those allegations and say where he heard them and who exactly is supposed to have said those. Who exactly is supposed to have said those things, Mr. Speaker? Because I certainly can tell him, and he asked about the October decisions, they were very bitter.
The rules on parliamentarians' expenses were really tightened up more than 10 years ago, and a few MPs were forced to resign over that. But that means that a lot of the Westminster sleaze that we used to talk about all the time has been eliminated. I think the reason that this has become such a big issue is that the Labour Party opposition doesn't have any clear policies or even really broad politics.
Tories are now debating who's behind the leaks, with the majority of fingers now pointing at former aide to the Prime Minister, Dominic Cummins. In the meantime, the opposition Labour Party has accused the government of showing contempt against the British people by engaging in such infightings.
An audit by the U.S. Agency for International Development, USAID, has revealed that Washington's effort in February 2019 to send aid to Venezuela was part of a plot to change the legitimate government of President Nicolas Maduro in the oil-rich Latin American country. The USAID report noted that the aid offer was not planned in alignment with humanitarian principles, but for supporting pro-Western figure Juan Guaido. That is while Venezuela was grappling with chronic shortages of food and medicine. The document said materials sent to the Colombian border region in February 2019 were planned to be distributed by the allies of Venezuelan opposition figure Juan Guaido to reinforce his credibility. The U.S. administration, under the former President Donald Trump, planned for the aid supplies to be carried out by Guaido's allies across the Colombian border into Venezuela. However, the Venezuelan government blocked the aid convoys at the time, calling the U.S. move a violation of the country's sovereignty. In reaction to the audit, the Venezuelan Foreign Minister Jorge Arreaza said the U.S. offered aid to the oil-rich nation 2 years ago in a bid to overthrow the government in Caracas. Also, the Venezuelan Information Minister Freddy Nunez called the so-called U.S. humanitarian support an excuse in which Washington sought to break Venezuela's territorial sovereignty. Venezuela descended into political turmoil after opposition figure Juan Guaido unilaterally declared himself as the interim president in January 2019. He claimed Maduro's re-election in 2018 was fraudulent. The Trump administration recognized Guaido as the legitimate leader of Venezuela and publicly pursued a regime change policy against Maduro. Meanwhile, the Biden administration has reaffirmed the U.S. recognition of Guaido as the interim president and has ruled out negotiations with Maduro anytime soon. Washington has been pursuing a regime change in Venezuela and has imposed crippling sanctions on the country to force Maduro out of power. The organization USAID has been accused of political interference in the past. It has used aid and the notion of democracy promotion to interfere in countries like Russia and Cuba. Venezuela has been no exception.
Well, I would say yes, the U.S. does lose credibility when its plans get exposed, but that won't deter the United States from trying to push forward these plans. Really, what we have in the U.S. is there's one end goal, one end and interest, and that interest is in the interest of imperialism, of trying to open up markets and take resources from other nations that the U.S. either does not have enough of or would want to have more of. You know, one of those resources in terms of Venezuela being oil.
The U.S. has been after regime change in Venezuela for quite some time, especially during the presidency of the former president Hugo Chavez, who was very vociferous in its anti-U.S. stance. The U.S. has refrained from recognizing Nicolas Maduro's re-election in 2018, freezing millions of dollars of Venezuelan money in U.S. bank accounts, and imposing sanctions on the crisis of the economy of the Latin American nation. What has been termed as economic terrorism, Washington is attempting to use sanctions as a leverage to overthrow the legitimate government of Maduro. Last month, Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro slammed Washington's plan to transfer $150 million of the country's frozen funds from offshore accounts to the opposition led by Juan Guaido. Maduro lashed out at both the U.S. government and the Venezuelan opposition, calling them a pile of gangster bandits. While freezing assets and slapping illegal sanctions on countries that refuse to submit to Washington's hegemonic policies is nothing new. The U.S. sanctions have directly targeted Venezuelan people who are stuck between the coronavirus pandemic and an economic crisis. There's also the case of the failed U.S.-backed coup plot. Venezuelan security forces arrested dozens of people, including two Americans, after a beach invasion allegedly aimed to overthrow President Nicolas Maduro. This was a plot which involved U.S.-backed opposition leader Juan Guaido. A Florida-based ex-Green Beret, Jordan Goodreau, told the Associated Press that he was working with the two American men in a mission launched early to liberate Venezuela.
I would point out that a lot of these failures are contemporary. They're things that are happening recently, and not to say that they weren't failures in the past, but we've seen how a lot of the regime change efforts in the past were far more successful than they have been recently. I think part of the problem for the United States, at least, is that the world is becoming a lot stronger and a lot more aware of some of the tactics that the United States is using.
Like other countries in South America, Venezuela is facing a harsh new pandemic wave, fueled by more infectious virus variants coming from neighboring Brazil. Experts say the sanctions, used as a tool for regime change, have no effect on the stability of the Maduro administration, but impact the socioeconomic condition of ordinary people amidst the COVID-19 crisis.
The first Palestinian national election in 15 years has been indefinitely delayed. Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas made the announcement following a meeting with Ramallah-based political factions on Thursday. Abbas blamed Israel and the uncertainty about whether it would allow the vote to take place in the occupied West Bank and Gaza for the decision.
Facing this difficult situation, we decided to postpone the date of holding legislative elections until the participation of Jerusalem and its people is guaranteed. Jerusalem will not be compromised, and our people in Jerusalem will not give up their right to exercise their democratic rights.
The decision came 3 months after he issued a formal decree ordering a vote for the Palestinian legislature on May 22nd and a Palestinian presidential election on July 31st, votes that could serve as an acid test for the legitimacy of the Palestinian political institutions, including his own presidency. Many observers believe the indefinite postponement is effectively a cancellation of the vote.
In my opinion, the best thing the Palestinian Authority can do is to dissolve itself. Anyone who tries to represent Palestinians today is compromised in some way, either because they are cooperating with the Israeli occupiers and oppressors, or because they can only operate if they're opposing them, as Hamas is. They can operate only within certain parameters because they're denied the ability to operate the way they would like to operate.
Hundreds of Palestinians staged a protest in Ramallah to denounce the decision. They chanted slogans calling for the formation of a legitimate government. Earlier in the day, hundreds of people had staged rallies in the Gaza Strip to condemn the Palestinian Authority chief's plans to call off the vote. The Palestinian resistance movement, Hamas, denounced Abbas's decision, calling it, quote, a coup. In a statement, Hamas said the move goes against the path of partnership and national consensus, issues that cannot be pawned as collateral for the agenda of a faction. It also noted that the Fatah movement and the Palestinian president bear full responsibility for the decision and its consequence. In a separate statement, head of Hamas political bureau, Ismail Haniyeh, condemned as unconvincing the decision, demanding that the elections of the Legislative Council, the Palestinian Authority, and the National Council be held at agreed schedules. He added that the resistance movement is ready to cooperate with all Palestinian political factions.
A Hamas win might be satisfying to many. It might be satisfying in the sense that it confronts Israel and that it stands up for Palestinian rights. But in fact, a Hamas win means probably more oppression and less opportunity from the Israeli side, and it very possibly will be used as a pretext for Israel to be even more oppressive and to accelerate their genocide and ethnic cleansing of Palestine, because their ultimate objective is to have no Palestinians in Palestine.
Israeli authorities have made many efforts to either cancel or postpone the polls. Israeli forces have escalated an arrest campaign targeting key Hamas figures in the West Bank in recent months. Observers are drawing a parallel between the recent arrests and those made in the run-up to the 2006 elections, which resulted in a sweeping victory for Hamas.
A prominent international rights group has accused Israel of pursuing policies of apartheid and persecution against the Palestinian people. Human Rights Watch says the policies amount to crimes against humanity. In a 213-page report, the HRW points to Israeli restrictions on Palestinians' movements and land grabs for the construction of settlements in the territories occupied in 1967, calling them examples of policies that are crimes of apartheid. The rights groups and Israeli authorities have pursued intent to maintain domination over Palestinians by exercising control over land and demographics for the benefit of Israelis across the occupied territories. HRW called on the International Criminal Court to investigate and prosecute individuals credibly implicated in the apartheid and persecution. This says just a few weeks back, the court said it would investigate war crimes by the Israeli military in the occupied West Bank and Gaza Strip. This brings to the spotlight the fact that the regime has continued with its violation of Palestinians' rights for decades amid silence of the West in dealing with such crimes.
Well, I think it's very welcome. It really doesn't, to those of us who have any familiarity with the reality on the ground there, there are no real revelations, nothing new. And one of the thoughts that comes to mind is what's taken them so long to acknowledge these realities. But nevertheless, it's welcome that they are acknowledging them now, I think. And the report in particular, I haven't had a chance to read every word of it, but I've skimmed through it and read the summary and so on. One of the things it does that I think the previous statements in this area have not done is to do a pretty rigorous analysis of what international law actually says and to make the case that the realities in Palestine actually match the international legal definitions of these crimes against humanity, specifically the crime of apartheid, and something that was new to me as a legal concept, the crime of persecution.
The report by the Human Rights Watch comes as even Israeli advocacy groups have accused Israel of being an apartheid regime. Just a few months back, advocacy group B'Tselem said that Israel is an apartheid regime that systematically oppresses the Palestinians via military occupation and racist laws. B'Tselem said the regime in Tel Aviv uses laws, practices, and organized violence to cement the supremacy of one group over another. It added the Israeli apartheid, which promotes the supremacy of Jews over Palestinians, was not born in one day or of a single speech. The group added this is a process that has gradually grown more institutionalized and explicit, with mechanisms introduced over time in law and practice to promote Jewish supremacy.
You know, it's true that it has gradually been more institutionalized and consolidated. On the other hand, I have to say, I first went to the occupied territories, specifically, to both the West Bank and to Gaza in 2002, and I don't claim any special enlightenment, but all this was pretty obvious to me back in 2002. So, it takes a long time for these groups to face up to the reality, which was pretty clear to me way back then.
Israel occupied the West Bank and East Jerusalem al-Quds during the Six-Day War in 1967. It later annexed East Jerusalem al-Quds in a move not recognized by the international community. Palestinians want the West Bank as part of a future independent Palestinian state with East Jerusalem al-Quds as its capital. But Israel's aggressive settlement expansion and annexation plans have dealt a serious blow to any prospects of peace. Meanwhile, the Gaza Strip has been under an inhumane Israeli land, air, and sea blockade since 2007 and witnessed three wars since 2008.
Of course, they're outrageous and shocking, and no other country in the world would be able to go on with impunity and continue to be acknowledged as a great democracy and to get billions of dollars in U.S. aid every year and so on and so on. It's, frankly, I think it's because of the power of the Zionist forces and the political power, cultural power of Zionist forces in the United States that makes this all possible.
That said, what better characterizes Israel's apartheid practices are Tel Aviv's violations, including unlawful killings, forced displacement, abusive detention, the siege of the Gaza Strip, and other unjustified restrictions on movement and the expansion of settlements. However, what can only bring the Israeli apartheid policies to an end is a united front by the international community against such practices that are only aimed at dislodging the Palestinians from their land, namely Palestine.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
U.S. President Joe Biden's approach to the Zionist regime's apartheid practices speaks volumes about Washington's insincere rhetoric about Palestinians enjoying their rights, says Ramon Awadi, journalist, in an article titled, U.S. is shielding Israeli regime from apartheid claims and itself from complicity charges. Stay tuned, please, for the details of this article. The Palestinians mentioned apartheid in connection with the Zionist regime long before B'Tselem used the description. Now it is the turn of Human Rights Watch, HRW, to rightfully, if belatedly, accuse the Zionist regime of apartheid in its latest report titled A Threshold Crossed, Israeli Regime Authorities and the Crimes of Apartheid and Persecution. Also belated, but still welcome, is HRW's recognition that the temporary nature of the Israeli regime's military occupation of Palestine is no longer an accurate depiction of ongoing colonization process that international community has done nothing to halt. HRW says that its apartheid definition comes not from comparisons with South Africa, but is based upon the systematic violence of demographic change, oppression and control of the Palestinian people. When these three elements occur together, they amount to the crime of apartheid. A U.S. State Department spokesperson said that the Biden administration rejects HRW's report. It is not the view of this administration that Israel's actions constitute apartheid, it announced, not surprisingly. The department, no doubt, wishes to shield its client state from the very serious apartheid allegation, but itself from equally serious complicity charges. The Zionist regime, of course, is none too pleased with the renewed scrutiny of its policies and actions. With a pending investigation by the International Criminal Court, which Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has rejected, and B'Tselem's January accusations of apartheid coming from within, so to speak, the democratic facade which has served the colonial state so well, the international community has been dented. How far-reaching the impact will be remains to be seen. The duality of calling the Zionist regime an apartheid state while emphasizing its legitimacy is a contradiction which bolsters the settler colonial entity policies and practices. The same goes for the two-state compromise, which has facilitated the Israeli regime's apartheid by placing the burden upon the Palestinians to make concessions to their colonizer. Predictably, the Zionist regime's foreign ministry accused HRW of an anti-Israel agenda, the same allegation leveled at the UN and its institutions, despite the fact that The international organization has played a major role in enabling the Zionist colonization of Palestine. The financial claims that HRW concocted are both preposterous and false, bleated the ministry. To call HRW out for having an anti-Israel agenda is absurd. Many human rights organizations, HRW included, have routinely given the Israeli regime the benefit of the doubt in the past, shifting the onus of blame upon Palestinians and using terminology such as conflict to evade the reality of settler colonialism and related violence by nuclear-armed state against a largely civilian population. The Zionist regime's security and self-defense narrative, after all, is so widely promoted by the UN and world leaders that it is basically exempt from criticism. Moreover, the Israeli regime narrative has shielded it from accusations of war crimes and apartheid for decades, due to the international community's insistence on the Zionist regime's legitimacy, despite its contempt for international laws, conventions, and institutions. U.S. President Joe Biden's approach to the Zionist regime's apartheid practices speaks volumes about Washington's insincere rhetoric about Palestinians enjoying equal rights. It was only a few weeks ago that U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken urged this to be rectified within the context of the two-state paradigm, which has contributed to the entrenching of the Israeli regime's apartheid system. The joint U.S.-Israeli regime expectation is that the Zionist regime will continue to commit apartheid and other crimes while the international community normalizes and accepts them. Considering the military aid that the Zionist regime receives from the U.S., that is $3 billion every year, it is clear that Biden and his successors will need to alter U.S. legislation, which preludes American aid from going to countries guilty of human rights abuses, rather than admit that the Zionist regime is indeed an apartheid regime. Subcontinent.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen, this is John, and I welcome you back to another episode of The Subcontinent. Our program aims to address important issues in the subcontinent and overall in the region of South Asia. This episode focuses on the change in dynamics of the Chinese, Indian, and Pakistani relationship due to a big step being taken by China, and the brain drain of the Indian economy. Please stay with us and stay tuned.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we are going to talk about China's Digital Silk Road project and its revolutionary promises for communication and connectivity from Asia to Africa and Europe. And we shall take a look at the increasing rate of immigration by Indian millionaires to Western countries and what it means for the Indian society.
China is about to complete another part of its Belt and Road initiative, but this part of the Silk Road is digital. The Pakistan-East Africa Connecting Eurocable, abbreviated as PEACE, is now set for the final stretch. This cross-border fiber optic cable in Pakistan is the latest part of a continental network that is called the Digital Silk Road. It will connect to a submarine cable in the Arabian Sea to service Europe and countries participating in China's Belt and Road Initiative, the biggest infrastructure undertaking in the world.
China's ambitious Belt and Road Initiative, or BRI, has a digital side. Dubbed the Digital Silk Road, it is a colossal communication grid stretching from the Chinese mainland all the way eastward to Africa and Europe. The impacts of this digital Silk Road can potentially surpass the vast influence of the connectivity network on the ground or the seas, because the future is digital. China is fast becoming the global leader of cutting-edge technologies, and nothing seems to be able to stop it, not even a global disaster. When the COVID pandemic started to negatively affect some of the BRI projects, such as a $6.8 billion railway project in Pakistan, Beijing moved to speed up the digital aspect of the project, stepping up the development of the communications infrastructure. For all the partner countries along the way, the Digital Silk Road means higher quality in telecommunication with significantly lower costs, as well as more employment opportunities and technology transfer. However, there are some state and private players who are getting more and more frightened of the looming evolutionary leaps in cybersphere.
Forging the Digital Silk Road forward, China is bringing technology and additional benefits to participating countries by establishing training centers and R&D programs to boost cooperation between scientists and engineers in these countries and with their Chinese counterparts. Chinese firms are exporting know-how in areas such as telecommunications networks, artificial intelligence, e-commerce, cloud computing, smart cities, robotics, and clean energy, among others. So, who is against this project? Who doesn't want a better connected Eastern Bloc with China as its binding glue?
Since Beijing launched the Digital Silk Road DSR in 2015, it has increasingly become a substantial part of the overall strategy of the Belt and Road Initiative. Via the project, China provides economic support and technological assistance to recipient states. Observers see this as a strategic move to circumvent international telecommunication consortiums that are dominated by Western and Indian companies. The Hengtong Group, one of China's leading fiber optic and power cable makers, is heading a consortium of telecom companies from Africa, Pakistan, and Hong Kong to install the Pakistan East Africa Connecting Europe, or Peace Cable, in the Indian Ocean and the Mediterranean. The laying of sea cable in Pakistan's territorial waters is scheduled to begin in March, following government approval of CyberNet, a local internet service provider, to construct an Arabian Sea landing station in Karachi. The Mediterranean section of the cable is already being laid from Egypt to France, and the 15,000-kilometer-long cable is expected to go into service later this year.
Okay, so for further insight and analysis, we are joined by Mr. Mike Billington. He's an executive at the Intelligence Review. Mr. Billington, welcome to this show. So when China makes the digital road operational, it may be the end of the Western hegemony over the cyberspace. What is it that the United States is doing to topple this project?
Well, the most obvious is that under the last administration, under Mike Pompeo and his fanatic friends, they succeeded in breaking Donald Trump's effort to have a good relationship with China once they resolved the trade deal, and they were able to implement these vile, illegal attacks on Huawei and TikTok and other technologies coming out of China. So the Pompeo went around the world to basically browbeat countries into breaking from altogether and not using Chinese technology under threat of economic sanctions, under threat of isolation. So, you know, we'll see what happens with Biden. Biden, despite being a fanatic about shutting down the industrial infrastructure with his crazy Green New Deal, he has shown some signs that he wants to reestablish decent ties with China. He lifted the ban on TikTok. He lifted the effort to shut down WeChat. He hasn't said anything about Huawei yet, and he hasn't moved to release the daughter of the head of Huawei from this insane and illegal incarceration up in Canada. But these are things he could do, should do. He correctly identified after his two-hour call with Xi Jinping that China's main concern is that every time they have allowed internal disunity, they've been attacked by foreign forces, like the British Opium Wars and related things. So he recognizes that Xi Jinping needs to keep the country united, and he said he would not, Biden said he would not allow things to get back to these warring blocks from the Cold War days. We'll see if he lives up to it. He has to deal with a military-industrial complex, which even Trump was unable to overcome when he wanted to end the endless wars around the world. So it's a very dangerous moment, but we have to give him the benefit of the doubt that he's going to try to move towards cooperation with China, including dropping this crazy attack on Huawei and other IT.
Okay, so China has increased efforts and investments in the Digital Silk Road Project since COVID pandemic and economic problems have slowed down or even stopped China's progress in railroad and highway projects. Do you see a stop to this? And what role do you see of the U.S. administration in this regard?
I'm not sure that there's a stopping of the rail and road developments. Obviously, the pandemic and the lockdowns caused some problems. But I think the main reason we saw a slowing down of the infrastructure investments was because of the threatening war with the United States under Pompeo. So we'll see how this proceeds. I don't think there's any, like I said, other than the browbeating from the Pompeo and Christopher Wray types against other nations to not use Chinese technology. Other than that, I don't see anything that would stand in their way. It's well known that they have the best technology and by far the cheaper costs for most of this IT, and most countries are in great demand for this quality of work. It doesn't mean not working with the U.S. side of these things. China has never done what Pompeo's crowd did here and demand that people only work with China and not work with the U.S. and Europe. So I don't expect they will make those kinds of demands. And the only thing that could hold people back would be either real competition in the sense of better quality goods coming from the West, or the kind of, outright attack from the Pompeo types. And we're not clear yet which direction Biden's going to go on this thing. He's made some positive steps. He's also allowed the same line to come out of his cabinet that came out of the Trump cabinet about China is our adversary and their malign activities and their human rights violations and all these lies that were concocted as part of this McCarthyite witch hunt, racist witch hunt against the Chinese. So we'll see how this proceeds. The LaRouche organization is going to fight like hell to break through this anti-China hysteria amongst the population here and around the world, and to make it clear that if we don't get the U.S. and Russia and China working together to deal with the global economic crisis, the global pandemic, and all other global problems, that we're heading for a very, very dangerous situation, including the potential of a nuclear war.
Thank you so much, Mr. Billington, for being with us on our show. It was nice having you here. We've collected some social media coverages in this regard, and please stay with us.
Hua Chengying wrote on Twitter, "Since last year, the pandemic has affected the world in many respects. Yet despite the headwinds, Belt and Road Cooperation, BRI, has not paused, but forged ahead with new outcomes, strong resilience and great vitality." Stefan Horvath posted on his Twitter, "The initial focus of the Silk Road has been infrastructure investment, education, construction materials, railway and highway, automobile, real estate, power grid, and commodities." Piper Growth wrote on Twitter, 21st century Silk Road, China has emerged from exporting silk, porcelain, tea, and other products to high-end and new technologies such as AI, AIOT, fintech, and intelligent manufacturing. Laurie Leigh Claire believes China's policies for trade, economics, and technology far outshine the floundering USA, and with this new Silk Road, China will no longer need the US for trade. Trump trumped us all.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
Brain drain in India used to be an only small problem. But now, India's future is increasingly threatened by its severe case of wealth outflow, the emigration of the country's millionaires, or the so-called high-net-worth Indians. A large cut of India's GDP leaves the country every year. Considering the huge impact of this departure of human capital on the country's social and economic structure, the government may need to be faster on measures to reverse or at least reduce the figures.
It is a normal malady of the capitalist world that people accrue wealth in their home countries, then no longer feel fit for their society and move to another part of the globe, presumably for a better life. But wealthy Indians are on top of the list of those who leave their country through different investment programs. During the past 14 years, over 60,000 Indian millionaires have left the country, and in 2020 alone, more Indians than any country made inquiries for residence by investment or citizenship by investment programs. This shows a 63% rise compared with the figure of 2019. The 2020 Global Wealth Migration Review, issued in collaboration with the New World Wealth, found that in 2019, India had the second biggest wealth outflow after China. Investment-linked migration is not cheap, ranging from half to $1 million in average, but sometimes the price is more than money. Since India does not permit dual citizenship, opting for citizenship by investment means giving up the Indian passport. Almost all of these affluent Indians had already had lavish fantasy-like lifestyles. So what's wrong at home that can justify such a price? For any moves to address the issue, Indian authorities and policy makers may have to explore the thought process and reasons behind such a trade-off.
The richest Indians, who reportedly have been getting even richer despite the global chain of all the unfortunate events following the COVID-19 pandemic, are moving towards what is often called the developed nations. The top destinations for Indian millionaires are usually England, the US, Australia, the UAE, and Singapore. However, there are new favorites among Indians with deep pockets too.
Wealthy Indians aspire to migrate abroad over various reasons, from better employment opportunities to ease of doing business, from security concerns to better conditions of living and education. In addition to all-time favorite destinations, the top investment-linked residence and citizenship programs that Indians inquired about in 2020 were for residency for Canada, Portugal, Austria, Malta, and Turkey, as well as New Zealand, each for different reasons. Europe, for instance, is mentioned as the target of those who want to obtain better mobility, and North America for those who prioritize a better educational future for the next generation. However, each country has diverse good and bad points. For example, the US, Australia, and England have the same language with high standards of living, while countries like the UAE and Singapore have more convenient financial structures. With the surge in high net worth Indians leaving the country, capital is going out, talents are going out, entrepreneurial chances and prospects of a prosperous economy are going out. India needs effective plans and actions, perhaps up-to-date universities and regulations to ease business are a good start.
Now, to have more insight and analysis, we are joined by Mr. Uday Bhaskar, who is the Director of Society for Policy Studies. Mr. Bhaskar, welcome. So, why do Indian millionaires leave India? What are the factors behind the wealth outflow, and why did more than 5,000 millionaires leave India in the last year?
My reading is that this particular number that is being now mentioned, about 5,000 high net worth individuals, as they call, that they are choosing to leave India, represents about 2 to 3% of the total number of the high net worth individuals in India. So I want to place this in context, that while the number may be 5,000, it is about 2% of the total number of millionaires in dollar terms in India, which, if I recall right, in a 2018 study, the total number of millionaires in India was 256,000. So that is just to give you two sets of figures. Now, one reason why high net worth individuals are moving abroad is to look for better prospects, particularly for their children, because now education has become a very high priority for any parent in any part of the world. And because of the pressure of numbers, India is a young country. There are a number of young people who are knocking on the doors of the major educational institutions, whether it is the universities or the IITs, which are globally recognized, or medical schools, engineering, and so on. And clearly, the available educational capacity is not able to accommodate the aspirations of young India. And those who can afford it are looking for educational opportunities outside of India. And they generally go to countries where English is the language that is spoken. So by and large, you'll find that many of these people who are choosing to go outside of India and giving up their Indian citizenship in some cases.
All right, Mr. Bhaskar, before moving ahead, I would like you to see the media coverages in this regard, which our team has collected, and then we can move ahead. Please stay with us.
In 2020, wealthy Indians again topped the list of those making inquiries for residence by investment or citizenship by investment programs. The number of inquiries rose from 2019, said a facilitating agency. As per Global Wealth Migration Review issued by New World Wealth, a wealth intelligence firm, Indians were the second largest contingent among the millionaire category to move overseas. Nearly 7,000 wealthy Indians, comprising 2% of the HNWIs, left the country during 2019. It appears that the interest is not waning. India stands third on the list for the number of immigrants behind China and Russia. In fact, despite the ongoing Brexit issues in the United Kingdom, the outflow in India was recorded more than that in the UK, while China recorded the maximum number of migrations amid the trade war with the US. Interestingly, a large part of the outflow preferred settling in the US, Canada, and Australia, thanks to the climatic conditions, better education, universities and schools, healthcare, and tax system. Nevertheless, India's total wealth is set to grow at a handsome rate in the next 10 years. The GWMR notes that India will outperform the UK and Germany in terms of wealth generation to become the fourth largest wealth market in the world by 2028. Among the cities which will drive this growth in the next 10 years are Delhi, Bangalore, and Hyderabad. Delhi would do so on the back of its well-diversified economy and strength in a number of key sectors. Bangalore on its prowess in the fields of IT and R&D, and Hyderabad on the base of its being the pharmaceutical capital of India and its many special economic zones, the report said. Many Indian billionaires such as Lakshmi Niwas Mittal, UK, Nikki Jagtiani and Sunny Vaki, Dubai, M.A. Yusuf Ali and Shamshir Vayalil, Abu Dhabi, may have taken up residency abroad and turned non-resident Indian, but remained essentially Indian at heart. The list just grows, unarguably raising concerns for the government that is struggling to spread prosperity around and improve employment opportunities.
All right, welcome back, Mr. Bhaskar. So continuing now and moving forward, what are the impacts of the high rate of immigration among the Indian affluent society of the country's economy?
Well, definitely it's a kind of brain drain, because many of India's top educational institutions, particularly the IITs, that is the Indian Institute of Technology, the medical schools, the business schools, some of the engineering schools, the most, I would say, qualified, the top tier, would look abroad for better opportunities, because I think we must accept that they also get a much higher kind of, shall we say, material return, whether it is by way of salary or the way of life or long-term kind of prospects and so on, which again is a very natural kind of impulse. I think for India, this does pose, as I said, a certain challenge, because you train and educate these people within India, but yet they choose to make their lives abroad. But at the same time, you cannot prevent them, because I think that would not be correct either. So we have to find a way of attracting, retaining the Indian talent and giving them appropriate incentives. And I think the government is very, very aware of this, and they are trying to see how best to retain the Indian talent in India.
All right, that marks the end of this session. Thank you so much, Mr. Bhaskar, for being with us. We have collected some coverages of what has been going on cyberspace and social media in this regard. So please stay with us. Thank you.
Ninja Monkey believes, while many in India talk of brain drain, few are actually ready to pay top dollar for top talent. Fact is, if you really want to attract the best, you'll need to put your money where your mouth is. P. Surya Kumaran posted on his Twitter, "High proportion of US and Great Britain robotic surgeons are Indian. We would have a reverse brain drain problem if they went back to India." Ashish Shah wrote on his Twitter, "From brain drain to brain gain, India tech boom is bringing scientists and technologists back from the West to India." Meg Updates posted on his Twitter, "Indian Americans are taking over the country US. Joe Biden referring to NASA's successful mission and high numbers in his administration." Saket Kumar Chondhari wrote on his Twitter, "What is incredible in brain drain from India? Isn't this shameful that we aren't able to keep our talents with us? Sorry to say, but if you are the CEO of Gov's think tank, only God can save us."
All right, ladies and gentlemen, that's it for today. Today we covered the issues of the digital Silk Road and the emigration of Indian millionaires towards the Western countries. We'll meet next week.
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight. Across the world, several key mutant strains have emerged thanks to ongoing coronavirus replication in humans.
both ability to replicate and transmit and a better ability to escape our immune systems led to the variants establishing themselves as dominant strains across geographies and populations. We have prepared for you an article written by Rajiv Dasgupta. The piece is titled India's Double Viral Mutation Caused